From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. On February 8th, 2024, the world lost a tennis champion, a mentor to legions of children, a man who named his nonprofit after the principle that shaped his life. Lenny Simpson launched One Love Tennis and Education Fund in 2013 to reach at-risk children in Wilmington. The word love, of course, has multiple meanings. In tennis, it's used in place of nil or zero for scoring. But as you're about to hear, the late Lenny Simpson believed deeply in the power of love to change lives. We spoke with him in October of 2019. He was eager to tell his story, in part because it illustrated the very reason he started One Love. World tennis champion Althea Gibson gave Lenny Simpson his first tennis racket. Lenny Simpson has a lot to say about her, but in case you don't know, let's start with the way Venus and Serena Williams' own coach described Gibson, one of the greatest tennis players who ever lived. She broke the international tennis color barrier, and she has a monument outside Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York. The boy she called Champ went on to become a tennis champion in his own right. In 1964, at just 15 years old, he became the youngest male player to win a U.S. Open. He also drew the attention of Arthur Ashe, who became another mentor, and who he played at that same U.S. Open, who, he says, beat him like a drum, but that's later. Now let's join that 2019 conversation. Lenny Simpson, welcome to Coastline.
Hey, listen, thank you so very, very much, Rachel. Thanks so much for that tremendous introduction. And folks, if this was TV, you would see Rachel in this beautiful boa. I think that's what it's called, ribbon boa or scarf or something around her neck, which is absolutely beautiful and adds such great color in this room. So thank you so much for that introduction.
Thank you, Lenny Simpson. Actually, this is a prop that was left behind years ago by some unknown person at the station. It's a hot pink feather
boa. It's great. It's great.
And it's cold in the studio sometimes, so I wear it.
It looks great.
Thank you. It's early in the episode, but notice, this is what he does. He gives to the other person in the room generously, breaks any tension, and makes us both laugh. This is leading with love. Lenny Gibson, Simpson, Althea Gibson.
That's okay too.
She was the first person to cross the color line in professional tennis. And for those who weren't alive during that period or don't really understand the gravity of that moment and that accomplishment, what does that really mean? What's the significance of her crossing that line?
Althea Gibson, who, by the way, if you don't know this, folks, lived and trained right at 1406 Orange Street at the home of Dr. Hubert and Celeste Eaton.
Right here in Wilmington.
Right here in Wilmington, right in your front door, a world champion. But by simply getting that opportunity of him bringing her back from New York City, out of the slums of New York City, number one, saved her life. Number two, gave her a family structure. Number three, made her and helped her become a world champion. And the fourth thing, there's absolutely no doubt, Althea Gibson is the Jackie Robinson of tennis, without a doubt. If there had not been Althea Gibson, there is no Serena and Venus and thousands of others in between.
What was it like for an athlete who at that time was African American? Why was it different? And this may seem like an obvious question and answer to some people who lived during that time, but I know we have plenty of listeners who don't really understand that now because we see so many people of color who are athletic superstars in all kinds of sports. So what did it mean for Althea Gibson back then?
It meant everything for Althea Gibson back then. I mean, she has a book that she wrote, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody. Well, young lady, you certainly are somebody, without a doubt. So it meant everything to her, Rachel, to come along at that time and in the 50s and go through the adversity that she had to go through. Now imagine, folks, just to hit a little white tennis ball, to go through what was going on in our country at that time with race relationships. And if your skin was black, you had to go through an awful lot. I would just put it that way, in order to do anything in life, and certainly in order to succeed in the world of tennis. I mean, goodness gracious. Listen, African Americans in the world of tennis, everything was white. The tennis balls were white. The shorts were white. The t-shirts were white. The socks were white. The shoes were white. I mean, everybody in the stands were white. I mean, so that was a real troublesome and very, very, very tough time for her. Not only did she have to play against the best players in the world, but she had to worry about all the other things that were going on.
And you laid out a number of elements that may have made it possible for her to do those things, like family structure and being given a place to blossom. And you have kind of you're sort of like the next generation. Tell us about the first moment that you walked onto a tennis court. Because wow, that was also the moment that you met Althea Gibson, isn't it?
Yeah, the first time, though, my mom and dad built their home right around the corner from Dr. Hubert Eaton and Celeste Eaton. Family friends. Dr. Eaton was a very, very successful African-American civil rights activist in this town in so many thousands of ways.
And we're going to talk about him a little more and some of the things that he did to change this town.
Yes. But my mom did not want me to go to the tennis court and didn't want me to have anything to do with tennis at all.
Why?
Well, my mom and dad didn't know a thing about tennis. Nothing. They didn't even know that you hardly used rackets. They were too busy trying to make a living. They were both educators. My father was a school teacher and later on a principal of a school. My mom was in the school as a school teacher all of her entire life. They were all about education. Well, she did not want me going over to that tennis court to bother all of those adults because she felt that I was just going to be in the way. You don't need to be over there. So you're staying home and you're not going over there.
Well, you were going to be a little pest.
I was going to be an absolute pest. Well, I slipped over there between the two properties that joined each other. I slipped over there and I used to see this guy from around the corner go by the same time every day, all dressed in white with this wooden thing in his hand. And I'd be up in this oak tree in my front yard, a little tiny oak tree. Now it's huge. And I'd see him go by and he would disappear around the corner. And I go, his name was Mr. Nathaniel Jackson. And so then I'd see him come back and he would have a Coca-Cola in his hand. And I'd go, ooh, wait a minute. Where in the world did he get that Coca-Cola from? Well, I finally got up enough nerve one day and said, Mr. Jackson, how'd you get that Coca-Cola? He said, well, I'll be glad to take you one day to find out how you can get a Coca-Cola. I said, well, I can't go. You know, my mom is, you got to ask my mom. So you ask my mom and my parents, and my dad was fine with it. My mom was not. And so, this went on forever. And so I just slipped over there. And I slipped over, and I'd always heard all the noise and the laughter and the sound of that tennis ball coming from the tennis court. And I peeped up under the shrub. because there was beautiful shrubbery all around the court, all this greenery. And it was like magic, Rachel. It was like a whole nother world opened up to me. It was like going to Disney World in Wilmington.
What did you see?
Oh my gosh, I saw all of these people in white, dressed in white, hitting this tennis ball. And then I saw this one lady, about 6'3 in height, beating up on everybody that she played. Even me at 5, I could tell. She was the best there. And that was Althea Gibson. It was like magic. That's what I saw.
And then you were introduced to Althea Gibson.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, finally, I just said to my mom, look, Mom, I'm going over there, and I'm going to be disobedient. And every time I was, she would give me a spanking. Oh, yes. I got
she
a lot of spanking.
She spanked you every time you went next door?
Every single time I went next door. Because she said, I don't want you over there, and that's that. And I said, Mom, I finally said, Mom, I'm going over, so you may as well go ahead and spank me.
And we're and you're she, 5 years old at this
I'm five
point.
5 years old. Smart aleck. You know, mouth on me, just like I have now. But at any rate, she said, you know what, son? If you're willing to take that punishment and you want to go over there that badly, then you know what? I'm going to let you go ahead and do that. And lo and behold, Mr. Jackson came by the same time, 5 o'clock. And I said, Mr. Jackson, I can go to the tennis court. I can go with you. And he said, okay, come on. Does your mom know? I said, yes, you gave me permission. So we went around the corner, and I walk in these big gates. And he takes me in, and he introduces me. And lo and behold, the great Althea Gibson comes up to me and says, welcome, champ. What took you so long?
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with the late Lenny Simpson from 2019. He passed away in February of 2024. When we come back, what he learned from both Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're hearing from the late tennis champion Lenny Simpson, the youngest male to play in the U.S. Open, and a man who lived the idea of paying it forward. He passed away in early 2024, but 5 years earlier, he came to the Coastline studio to talk about what he learned from his mentors, tennis greats Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe. He explored what it was like to return to Wilmington as a celebrity for the Azalea Festival, how much he noticed had changed in the city as compared to his childhood when racist white people called the young Lenny Simpson names at the parade, names he still remembered. Let's return to that earlier conversation. Lenny Simpson, just before we went to break, you told us the story about meeting Althea Gibson, coming face to face with her for the first time after watching her secretly, or so you thought, through the shrubbery.
Yes.
And you said, on the tennis court, she was kicking everybody's butt.
Yes.
And you knew that even at 5 years old. So finally, your mom gives you permission. Mr. Nathaniel Jackson takes you over to meet her. And tell us again her first words to you.
It was incredible. I walk into these huge side gates of the property of Dr. Eaton's. And believe me now, you have to understand, Rachel and folks, that this is a very privileged few that walk inside of those gates on Dr. Eaton's property, because you had to do everything right on and off the court. So I come in with Mr. Jackson, and he takes me in, and he introduces me to the various people that are there, and then he finally introduces me to Althea Gibson. And she said to me, welcome, champ. What took you so long to get here? Those words have never left me to this very day, 66 years later.
Even,
I went over there at 5.
Even after you said that, just before we went to break, you had to take your headphones off.
Yes.
And wipe your eyes.
Absolutely.
You're still deeply moved by that moment and those words.
Yes.
What did that mean to you?
That meant everything to me. I get very emotional about it. You can hear it in my voice. There's no hiding of that. I'm very, very proud of that moment. For her to have taken the time for a little boy, 5 years of age, didn't know me, and for her to use the words champ, and what took you so long to get here, to me, that was just the most important thing that she could have ever said to me. If I'd never talked to her the rest of my entire life, that would have stayed with me all of my life. And I didn't know that she was the world champion at that time. Now imagine, I mean, someone taking that kind of time with you, a little boy, in the world of tennis, and to say those words to you and call you a champ. And I haven't even hit a tennis ball yet.
And you also learned in that moment that maybe your hiding in the shrubbery wasn't so secret.
It definitely was not so secret. I thought it was because she had seen me peering in under the shrubbery all that time and had never said anything to me, though. And, you know, just watched. And here I am now, finally inside the gates at the tennis court. It's amazing.
Now, your relationship with Althea Gibson developed. She became a mentor for you and arguably was instrumental in your becoming a tennis champion yourself. How did that relationship develop?
You know, it started at age 5. Every day after they all got through playing, there was a pecking order. And I was the youngest there. And so every day after all of them got through playing and their matches and everything, I was the ball boy. I ran the balls. I was the gopher. I cleaned the court. Hey, I did everything. I had a job to do there. And they would always, after they played, Mr. Nathaniel Jackson on one side of me, the great world champion Althea Gibson on the other side, would take time to practice with me on the backboard every single day. Now, this is a board that you hit up against and the ball continues to come back to you, folks, if you don't understand what I'm talking about. They would take that time to practice with me and instruct me and teach me the game of tennis. And Althea said, well, you're going to need a racket. Do you have a racket? I said, no, I don't have a racket. I mean, I'm 5. And so she says, well, here, I'm going to give you this racket. She gave me my first tennis racket. And I hit off the backboard with them for 2 years before I even got a chance to hit over the net.
Now, you went on 10 years later to play. You were the youngest person at the time to play in a U.S. Open.
Youngest male.
Youngest male.
Yes.
Okay. How did that happen, and how did you capture the attention of Arthur Ashe?
What a great question. I first met Ashe at 9 years of age, actually, because I was then sent to become a member of the junior development team with Dr. R. Walter Johnson in Lynchburg, Virginia. Well, Dr. Eaton and Dr. Johnson were doing networking before the word was even very popular. Dr. Johnson also had a private tennis court at his home. And it was their whole dream and vision was to find the best black athletes that they could find that were playing tennis and expose them further to developing their tennis game and giving them the opportunity to play this great game of tennis. So I would go there. And during the summer, I played in my first tournament at 8 in Durham, North Carolina, for experience. and I ended up winning the doubles. And so Dr. Johnson's team was there, and Dr. Eaton had told Dr. Johnson, look out for this young kid. I think you might have some talent there. And so Altheus, he had gone the same route previously. So had Arthur Ashe and so many other great, great players. And so Dr. Johnson saw me, talked to my parents about coming up there. And once again, my mom did not want me to go to Lynchburg, Virginia. She didn't even want me to go to the tennis tournament.
Why?
She did not. She just did not want me out of her sight.
Was she afraid for you?
She was afraid. Protective, you know, like moms are. Okay. And so she said, okay, I tell you what. The only way that I'll let him go to the tournament is if I take the other boys to the tournament. And I'll stay there with them. And when my mom saw me play my first match, she literally broke down and cried. Because she had no idea of the talent that I had and how she had maybe been holding me back. And that was an incredible moment. And so from that point on, I was on the junior development team for 11 years. Dr. Johnson assigned Arthur Ashe to take care of me. The older kids took care of the younger kids. So Ashe was 15, I was 9, so he had to look after me. And that's how that relationship started at age 9.
Eventually, the two of you developed an agreement where, tell us about that. You were going to stay in touch, and you made a commitment to that.
We did. We made a commitment to talk to each other and not let 7 days go by without having a conversation by phone or however, to stay in touch the rest of our entire lives. And that is exactly what we adhered to. And he was an amazing guy. I mean, I am so blessed to have had those relationships and those role models.
And I want to hear about your time at the U.S. Open. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with the late Lenny Simpson. He passed away in 2024, but the insights from this 2019 interview are still deeply relevant. So you're 15 years old. You go to the U.S. Open to play. And that started off pretty well, but then you had to play Arthur Ashe.
Yeah, I tell you, Rachel, you know, I got there at 15, and I'd been playing on the ATA circuit, which is the American Tennis Association, which was a circuit for black players. Remember, I could not play on the USLTA circuit.
What year are we talking about?
We're 1964. Talking 1964. So I'd only played maybe one USLTA tournament previous to that. And so here I am now at the U.S. Open at 15 at Westside Tennis Club in New York City. I'm going, wait a minute, hold it. This is, I don't know what to do here. And so I had my coach there, Dr. Johnson, of course, and, you know, Althea had been there, and Arthur Ashe and all of those. I mean, so Ashe was there with me. And so, now here's a funny thing. There's 128 players in the draw. I won my first round match, which they had no idea that I was going to do, and ended up beating the Italian champion, Pietro Gelli. I'll never forget this, which was a total upset.
Wow.
Yeah. But then there were only one other black player in the tournament, my doubles partner, Lewis Glass, myself, and Arthur Ashe.
Uh-oh.
Well, now, folks, how in the world did I end up playing a guy that I see every day in Lynchburg, Virginia, in the U.S. Open in the second round? Just think about that for a second.
Whose job it is to take care of you.
Exactly.
And so, he took care of you.
Oh, he took care of me, okay. He beat me like a drum. I mean, I will never forget that drubbing. I was scared to death.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd never played on grass courts. That was completely new. I couldn't practice at Westside Tennis Club in New York. I couldn't practice there. So I couldn't practice and get ready of how to play on grass, which is totally a totally different world. So here I am playing the great Arthur Ashe. And in the second game of the match, he tries to relax me and, you know, make me feel good about myself and all of this. And so I serve the ball and come into the net behind it to hit a volley. A volley is hitting the ball out of the air before it bounces. And he throws me up a nice high lob in the air. And you're supposed to go back and hit an overhead smash and hopefully win the point. I missed the complete ball. That's how scared I was.
Yeah, this was all nerves.
All nerves. And there were 10,000 people watching because we played on the grandstand courts. We were supposed to play in the stadium because he was seated seventh in the world at that particular time. I never would have made it if we'd played in the stadium. There's no question. I wouldn't even have gotten out of the tunnel. So it was unreal. Yes.
And I want to, we'll come back, but I want to jump ahead to what you're doing today, because you traveled around the world and you lived in Knoxville, Tennessee for quite a while and just came back to Wilmington about 6 years ago with your wife. Your kids are grown. You really felt this strong desire to pay it forward because you were given so much. And the way you talked about Althea Gibson and what she had when she was coming up, what were some of those things, again, that you think contributed to her success and also to yours? Family structure, you said?
Family structure, number one. I had two great parents in my family. Straight middle class, hardworking. My sister and I believed in education, believed in making good decisions, believed in doing things the right way. Althea got that from Dr. Hubert Eaton and Celeste Eaton. Now, let's make no mistake about it. If it had not been for Celeste Eaton teaching Althea Gibson all about the social graces in life, Althea Gibson never would have made it in Wilmington, North Carolina. People don't understand that. They don't know about that. Celeste Eaton was the backbone for the great Althea Gibson. Taught her everything that she needed to know to survive in Wilmington, North Carolina, in the South, and survive all over the world with having social graces. Because when she came here, she had none. It was very, very tough from what she came out of. So you have to have the discipline, the structure, and you got to have the want. You got to have the heart to win.
Do you think that there are more, I mean, I guess just numbers, there would be more at-risk kids today than there were at the time. But is it less typical today for a kid to have what you had, that kind of family support, that kind of community structure where all these other adults were looking out for you? I mean, that's what you're trying to give back now to kids who don't have it. But were you surprised when you came back here at the need?
I was absolutely floored. You know the statement or the saying, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Well, folks, we have the same problem, not only in this community, but all over this country. The family structure has been destroyed. No fathers in the family. If there is a father, he or she is maybe on drugs or has been in jail or in prison. The family structure is gone in this country, and especially for young black men in particular. Their role models are gone from the families. The moms are raising the kids. It's very difficult for a mom to raise a son and not have that male in the family. So I saw a lot of that. So when we came back to Wilmington to participate as a celebrity guest in the Azalea Festival, 5.5 years ago, I started looking around and I drove down Market Street and I said, you know, when I was 9 years of age, I was sitting on the curb with my parents down at the parade, listening to all of the name calling behind me of my parents sitting there, and they didn't want us to the parade anyway. Didn't want us to be there anyway.
What are you talking about? Name calling.
Name calling, meaning the N-word, all of the names, pick one.
People at the parade were saying this to you. To you and your family.
That is exactly correct. In the Azalea Festival, when I was young, 5, 6, 7, 8.
So this would have been the early 50s?
50s.
Okay.
Early 50s. And so I started remembering that, and I went, wait a minute. Now I'm back here as a celebrity guest of that same Azalea Festival when I used to sit on the curb as a little boy, and all I wanted, Rachel, was a piece of candy from the clowns coming out of the little funny cars. That's all I wanted. And I heard all of these names and, you know, this and that. And so I looked to my right, and there was a VIP podium. And I said, whoa, in 2 days, I'm going to be on that VIP podium. The little boy that was on that curb that never saw anybody that looked like him in that parade, and I just wanted a piece of candy and heard all the names. I'm on the VIP podium now. That's how much things have changed in this community, in this daggone town. And so I said, right then and there, I said, wait a minute, you know what? Maybe it's time for me to come back home and to make a difference in this community and give the young boys and girls in this community the same opportunity that was afforded me by Dr. Eaton, Arthur Ashe, Nat Jackson. The names go on and on and on. And that was kind of when One Love was born.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with the late tennis pro and One Love founder, Lenny Simpson. After this short break, what Lenny Simpson thinks newer generations of parents need to understand, and why discipline and consequences can and must coexist with love. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When Lenny Simpson was just 5 years old, Althea Gibson handed him a tennis racket and called him champ. That moment changed his life. He went on, at age 15, to play his mentor, Arthur Ashe, in the U.S. Open. Lenny Simpson returned to Wilmington in 2013 and launched One Love Tennis in honor of the mentors who did so much to help him live into his potential. Althea Gibson, Dr. Hubert Eaton, Arthur Ashe are some of those mentors. Let's rejoin this conversation from 2019, and if you can, listen to the end when Lenny Simpson explains why he believes relationships are the only path to real integration. Lenny Simpson, you talked about being at the Azalea Festival parade all these years later as a VIP and understanding suddenly the influence that you could have on the lives of some kids here. And you started One Love Tennis. What does that mean, One Love?
One Love means everything to me and to my family. The way it really started was I did not come up with the name. My communications director, Mark Sinclair, who is with me every single day, I went to the YMCA to tell them about what I wanted to do and my vision, to meet with the CEO there. And the CEO was not there, and so I went to the next person, you know, and the sports director at the Y. So I was telling them, you know, what I wanted to do and how I wanted to reach kids and give them the opportunity that I had and, you know, all of that. And he was sitting there very patiently listening and everything. He thought I was completely nuts. And so he said, well, do you have a name for it? I said, oh, yeah, I've got a name for it. I mean, Lenny Simpson Tennis and Education Fund. I mean, what else could it be called? I mean, what a mouthful, right?
Yeah.
Lenny Simpson Tennis and Education Fund. And he said, well, don't you think that's a little long? That's a lot of words. I said, yeah, it is a lot of words, but guess what? If it's good enough for my good friend, Arthur Ashe, who has the Arthur Ashe Tennyson Education Fund in Philadelphia, it's good enough for me. He said, oh, okay, excuse me, I understand that. He said, but why don't we call this, why don't we call it One Love? And I went, whoa, wait a minute. Stop right there. Don't go any further. What a great name for what we want to do. Because, see, love is the greatest gift that God could ever give to us. It's the gift of love. And that is what we are trying to give to each and every one of these young boys and girls in this community, no matter who they are, what they are, no matter what color they are, no matter whether they have three cars and a picket fence around their home or they don't have anything. If they want to play the game of tennis and they want to make the right decisions in life and get an education, then, hey, we're going to give them, my wife and I, and the rest of the people that work with us and the volunteers that believe in what we're doing in this community, we're going to give them every chance to succeed in life just like I had.
You also, there's a principle that you learned from Arthur Ashe. And when we were talking earlier before the show, I asked you, we were talking about whether evil exists. It went pretty deep before we turned on the microphones. And I also asked you, what about all the kids that you don't touch, that you lose? And you had a really clear answer about that and said you just focus on one at a time.
Absolutely. That's what Arthur Ashe told me when I was 10 years of age.
What did he say to you?
He said, the way you change this world, Lenny, never forget it. He told me several things, but that one was paramount. Because he said, the way you change this world is you change it by changing the lives of one person at a time. That's how you change the world. You cannot save every kid that I have learned, my wife and I have learned. You can't save them all. You have to save the ones that, number one, Rachel, want to be saved. And number two, are willing to make the sacrifices to do the right thing in order to have a chance to succeed in life. Other than that, that's where the line stops.
And you require a lot of these kids.
Yes,
I mean,
we do.
You don't spoon feed them, really. You give them a lot of love, but
absolutely,
you have expectations in return, and there are consequences if they don't meet those expectations. Tell us about that too. How do you feel about this generation of parents who has a harder time with consequences and accountability?
This generation of parents, I tell you, we have got to work on that. I have, you know, two daughters, and they are raising my grandkids. And, you know, listen, you know, I'm old school. I understand that. But goodness gracious, you got to have discipline. You have to have structure. Those kids have to know who the adults are and who the kids are. You know, when I grew up, my parents and my grandparents always told me as a kid, you know, a kid is to be seen, not heard. It's just the opposite now. The kids are running the adults. They're telling them what they are going to do and what they are, where they're going to go and what time they're going to come in and who they're going to date and what music they're going to listen to. And they have no social skills. Because all of them are in front of that daggone phone listening and sending messages all the time. Listen, when my grandkids come to see my wife and I here, everybody put up their phones. Because see, you're in my house. You put your phones up. We are going to socialize. We are going to talk to each other. We are going to laugh together. We're going to talk about various things. That is where I am with this generation of youngsters that are trying to raise young boys and girls in this day and time.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Lenny Simpson, tennis champion and founder of One Love Tennis in Wilmington. We spoke in 2019. He passed away in early 2024. But the lessons he learned and then taught to new generations, those live on.
Tell us about some of the kids that have come through One Love, because you're already in just the few years. It's been 6 years and 5 years that you've had it open.
A little over five and a half to be exact.
Yeah. So you're already starting to see some fruit from this effort. Tell us about one of the children.
It has been absolutely incredible. We go through 550 kids a week at the height of the season during the summer. During the off season, when we go back to school, like right now, we probably go through 300 kids a week. A lot of kids.
Yeah.
We see every color from every economic background, from every family structure. It is amazing, Rachel, of what this program is doing and how God is blessing this program and the people in this community that are supporting it, making the contributions, believing in what we're doing. Because I tell you something, we hope, and I really know that we are going to change this community. Because see, Rachel, if I can change one young boy or young girl to come back and stay here or come back and do what I am doing, we've already succeeded. We have a chance to do that with 10 or 20. Now, 10 or 20 coming back here, doing what we're doing with One Love, it'll change this community without a doubt. We have a young lady named Nina Noble. And I'll tell you the name of the person, Nina Noble. This young lady started with me right from the beginning. The brightest young lady that I have ever seen in my entire life. She will become president or anything that she wants to be. It is incredible what she is doing in school. It's incredible what she's doing on the tennis court. She's now just turned 15 and is kind of like the spokesperson for One Love. And how she helps the other young kids and how she tells them what they need to do and the struggles. It is absolutely amazing. If she walked in here right now and you didn't know who it was, you would know exactly who I'm talking about, because she has what we call the it factor.
And so you're getting to see this in the next series of generations. And one thing that we haven't talked about, and we have just a few minutes left, but the Eatons were such an important part of molding you and shaping you and helping you set your expectations very high and helping you embed values and principles by which you live today. For those who don't know who Dr. Hubert Eaton was, can you tell us a little bit about this man who was an important physician in Wilmington and who did a lot to force integration during a time when segregation was legal?
Absolutely. Dr. Eaton, Hubert Eaton, was one of the best and greatest civil rights activists that I know. He was the chairman of the board of the UNCW.
And he actually, for Wilmington College,
that's right,
was not admitting black students. And he was instrumental in forcing what is now UNCW to do that.
Absolutely. Was chairman of the board, imagine. Also integrated the YMCA, the library, sued the Board of Education, because his girls and son could not go to school at New Hanover High School, and they were two blocks away, sued the Board of Education, and won.
And he was one of those people who said, it's separate but not equal. He pointed out that there were serious deficiencies in the schools that were serving children of color.
Absolutely. When the children of color are using the leftover books, the leftover desks, I remember that very well, sitting at Williston Junior High School before I got the opportunity to go off to private prep school in Pennsylvania and Connecticut to get the greatest education there was. But Dr. Eaton was just an unbelievable force. I mean, there's Eaton Elementary School named after him. I mean, I can go on and on. He was the first doctor to be to do his residency at New Hanover Regional Medical Hospital, the home that we're restoring. He had his own dark room where he had to develop X-rays because black people could not be and get an X-ray at New Hanover Regional Hospital. So he would take the X-rays and develop them at his home and take them to his office to develop those X-rays. Martin Luther King, on his way here to Wilmington, North Carolina, Dr. Eaton had set all of that up. He was going to stay at his home. And when he turned around to go back to Memphis, you know, and what if he had stayed at Dr. Eaton's home and that had never happened? But that's where he'd planned on staying. He was an incredible civil rights activist.
So tell us, I read a little bit about all how much he used the courts to force integration during a time when the white population was resistant, and even when it became illegal, there's still been some intractability here, especially in Wilmington, and there are still there's still evidence of the division here. And you say that we've come a long way, and that little boy who was on Market Street watching the Azalea Festival parade and being called names jumped to that grown man who's a tennis champion and pro, changing people's lives, now on the VIP stand at the Azalea Festival parade. But what do we still have to accomplish here in terms of carrying forward Dr. Eaton's legacy and what he would have wished?
I think what we have to accomplish is the bar has been set very, very high by Dr. Eaton and Celeste and so many others in this town. It's all about relationships. It just can't be about, I can go to school and sit next to a white kid in school. It just can't be about that I can go and sit at a lunch counter now. I can go to any restaurant. I can go to the beaches now. It's got to be about relationships. It's got to be that my kid plays with your kids. My kids go to your house for dinner. Your kids come to my house for dinner. Understanding the cultures. I didn't say everybody had to agree and it was kumbaya. That's not what I'm talking about. But you gotta have a relationship. You've got to understand each other and you have to listen to each other. There's too many of us on both sides of the spectrum now. Let's not get it twisted. There's enough blame to go around, whether you're black or white, green or blue. You got to learn to listen to each other and talk to each other. It's all about relationships. And that is what has to be done in this town. Or the more things change, the more they're going to remain the same.
Lenny Simpson knew how to make a point. He passed away in early 2024, but his words of wisdom, driven by love, remain. That's this edition of Coastline. Our technical director is Ken Campbell. Find the episode at whqr.org or wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.